Welcome to our new PR Week podcast episode with John Harrington.
Welcome to a special edition of the PR show from PR Week, which is all about the UK Top 150 Consultancies report. As you may know, PR Week recently published our annual agency rankings alongside a series of features looking at major themes and developments in the sector. I'm John Harrington, Deputy Editor of PR Week UK, and I'm delighted to be joined by three top agency bosses to discuss the findings. We have Joanne Robertson, CEO and partner at Ketchum London, Bibi Hilton, MD of Golin London and also President of Women in PR, and Warren Johnson, founder of W Communications. Welcome to you all. I'm going to give a brief overview of our findings under different headings, then we'll crack on with the discussions. Firstly, I wanted to look at the overall trading picture in 2018 and 2019. What we found from our table was that growth in the top 150 accelerated slightly to 9.1% versus 8.1% in 2017. This is for the calendar year. We noticed that there were several financial PR powerhouses that benefited from a stronger M&A and IPO market, which probably impacted on the overall figures considerably. Elsewhere, some of the bigger players experienced slower growth, and there were general signs that there was some client reluctance in some ways of committing to accounts, and some sluggish consumer spending and so on, meaning there were some relatively difficult headwinds. Then again, quite a lot of agencies were saying that actions that they've done themselves, such as, you know, diversifying their offer, has helped. And there were also several areas where trading generally was reasonably strong, such as agencies that combined corporate and public affairs, and some of the various sort of specialists that were still doing pretty well, and areas such as pharma too. So who would like to kick us off on a discussion about this? I guess first question might be, how would you describe 2018 in a word, trading-wise, and 2019 in perhaps another word? Who would like to start?
Can I use more than one word?
You can use up to three words.
2018 was another strong year. 2019 is good but challenging. I think we were discussing earlier that it's there's obviously fun and games and things like Brexit, but I think that the whole global economy is looking certainly in increasingly uncharted waters, and I think that where client outlook is certainly less confident than it was 12 months ago, and I think that's going to affect us all in some way, shape or form.
Yep. Either of you like to come in on a...
Yeah, I don't know. Trying to get a PR person to sum that up in one word, John, I think that's quite difficult. I think from our perspective, last year, IPG, we did kind of mid-single digit, which is pretty much in line with our competitive group. I think that definitely recognise some of the headwinds that you talked about. Where we're seeing the kind of real strong areas of growth is in healthcare and technology. Mm. I think our kind of combined healthcare teams are just doing phenomenally well at the moment. And also we're seeing a real growth in kind of integrated work, so working hand in hand either with our other sisters across the IPG group. So as some of our big consumer clients are looking to consolidate, that's actually really good for us because as part of a kind of holding company integrated team, we're doing well off the back of that. But also working with our sister Brooklyn Brothers, we've had some good wins like Water Wipes in the last year. So
good stuff.
I can do it in one word. I think, and I think 2018 and 2019 are the same, which is roller coaster. So I think there are moments of extreme highs, which is really great for the agency and for the network, and then there are moments that are really difficult. But I think in terms of, it's great to see the industry as an overall in the UK in growth, because I think it's never been harder for everybody, no matter what their size or scale, to really drive that growth. So people are having to really prove themselves to every client that they have and also in every opportunity that comes in. So, you know, great to see growth, but definitely a roller coaster.
Mm. This point about a lot of agencies saying that they've benefited from diversifying what they do and sort of really focusing on different areas. Obviously, Bibi, you highlighted a couple of examples there. I mean, are there any other ways in which you've seen this trend play out in 2018, 2019? Are there other kind of areas in which, you know, maybe PR can eat more of Adland's lunch or...
Well, I think clients have never been more open-minded in the sense that the PR partner, as it's been seen, there's now a real recognition that we can do more than we've ever done before. And I think there's also a recognition that our talent base thinks more broadly, more laterally than maybe some of our creative industries brothers and sisters. And so as long as we are focused, keeping earned at the core, because that's who we are and what we've where we've come from, it's our true kind of expertise, surrounding that with new skills, different talent is definitely, I think, a path to continued growth.
Good. I think the meaning of diversification has changed in the last couple of years. I think that we went through a phase as an industry, and I've certainly seen that within our own agency, of diversification means we can sell advertising, we can go out and sell, you know, everything that everyone else in Marcoms can sell, and sort of losing sight a bit of our PR roots. And I think now we've kind of moved for diversification to mean, okay, it's about other disciplines and skills, but that are much more intrinsically linked to what we do as a PR business, but making that better. So, for example, yes, we've built and invested in data analytics, but rather than selling that as a completely separate piece of consultancy, it's about, okay, so how do we use that then to do better creative work or exactly. better media relations or better measure the impact of the work that we're doing, rather than trying to diversify into lots and lots of different disciplines.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think the kind of build on it is that we have made ads this year for Unilever, but we've done it with the PR lens on and we've not thought, let's go into advertising. But when there's been a kind of winner-takes-all brief on the table with multiple agencies, when there's come a case where actually the PR view on it is more interesting than the ad agency's view, and actually we can produce content, as I'm sure you guys can as well, for a tenth of the cost that some of the ad agencies can, to be able to be agile and creative for big multinational brand is really effective for them. And I think our job, you know, all of us that are doing well at the moment are doing well because we're able to help sort of charter the sort of quite challenging waters with our clients. And if we can help them do better in terms of cost savings, not reducing output, then I think we're all going to be in it and do well.
Good. It'd be good to sort of go through perhaps how 2018 panned out in terms of, you know, quarter by quarter, and how that's kind of developed as 2019 has gone on. Was there a sense that there was one time that was distinctly more difficult than another time, or and how do you think the sort of toing and froing of Brexit and other macro issues, like, you know, the sort of kind of possibilities of the trade war with China and the US and all of that sort of thing has kind of played out here, really?
I think for us, last year was pretty solid growth and followed the relatively standard patterns that it normally does. This year follows a pattern that you could have probably predicted, which is we had a stellar January, February. March was terrible. The minute that we knew what we knew what the uncertainty of Brexit looked like, then this month has been phenomenal. It's been our best month ever. And it's exactly what happened around the referendum vote, where the month running up to the vote was really, really poor. The month afterwards was our best on record. And it's really a case, seemingly, of people holding things back, trying to sort of hedge whether there might be an advantageous outcome for them, realising that there probably isn't. And then it's kind of business as usual. So I've seen that repeat itself twice now.
Interesting. Have either of you sort of seen a similar view, or is it just...
No.
I don't think so. I'd say our 2018 followed the pattern it always does. You know, Q2 and 3 are always our busiest quarters. You know, Q4 is traditionally, you know, a lot of pitching, etc. So I wouldn't say it's... I don't think that we can draw lines of any real material impact from Brexit. I think that a lot of the big blue chips we work on, I think, have been... planning in inverted commas as much as you can for a long time, and I don't see a particular correlation between that and the uncertainty and necessarily what we're seeing in our business.
Yeah, I'd say exactly the same. Now 2018 was the same as most years, and I think anecdotally we hear a lot of the big global clients talk about what they might do given the outcome of Brexit, but in terms of the toing and throwing, we're not really seeing them react to that, which is good.
Good. Okay, well, I'm doubtful we'll come back to a lot of these themes as we go through, but I'm going to look at our next sort of subject area, which is looking at priority areas of investment. We asked the top 150 entrants where they're sort of putting most of their focus when it comes to investments at the moment. And what we found was really a kind of an interesting mix of traditional and non-traditional services as the biggest priority areas. The area that was top was digital content, which was followed closely by media relations. And then we had things like general marketing services sandwiched between traditional areas, I suppose, like B2B and crisis risk management. I mean, our assessment here is that while PR firms want to obviously adapt and modernise, they also can't keep their eyes off the fundamental PR services. And as earned media comes to the fore, linked to kind of quite a lot of turmoil in Adland, who can blame them? What are your thoughts on this topic? You know, the sort of most important areas to focus attention at the moment.
Well, I think it's, I don't think we're any different from any other industry that has to modernise while keeping their eye on the fundamentals. That any good business should be doing that no matter where they are in the world or what sector they're in. But I think the fundamental thing for every agency should be it's not or, it's and. Because at the end of the day, as Bibi just said, you know, our heartland is always going to be earned. And we have to be clear what that is. It's not necessarily media relations per se, but it's earning the right to be in a conversation and have a conversation. So it doesn't surprise me that digital content and media relations are up there, because they're two really critical ways in which you earn, you know, trust, respect, engagement, conversation, all the things that are really important to our clients. So I think it's smart that we're doing that, and clearly that's part of the reason why it's driving growth in the industry.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'm surprised that data analytics didn't come up as one of the top areas. And maybe it did.
Yeah, it was. I mean, these are the real top ones. I mean, we did ask, that was among those that was chosen. I mean, there was also another area of, we asked about sort of brand, sort of purpose marketing, cause marketing, that sort of thing, which had, you know, a reasonable number of people sort of ticks that box. I get the impression if we'd have done this 2 years ago, no one would have ticked that box, or very few. So I think these are sort of interesting sort of subsects.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, you know, data is one where perhaps I thought maybe more would.
Yeah, particularly because from an investment perspective, because I guess we were talking about this a bit before this conversation started about, I think there's a difference between priority areas for us as a business. And I agree with Joanne that some of those have been as long as this industry has been going on, and then areas for investment. And that's the reason I think it's interesting to talk about data analytics, because that is, well, certainly for our business, it's a priority area, but it's also an area that requires significant investment, because you can't pivot classic PR talent into doing that. You need people who are specialists. You need to be investing in new platforms and tools, and training people to be able to use and to sell those and to integrate it into your business. I think that is quite a significant investment. Talking about cause-related marketing, some of those other areas, I think that is, yes, priority areas, but in terms from an investment perspective, that's often about pivoting people who maybe have working in adjacent areas or had kind of been working that before, but maybe it hadn't actually been developed as a full specialism for that agency. So
I think the one other area that's perhaps not been covered is sector expertise. I think that we talk a lot about services, but we actually don't talk enough about learning our clients' business. And certainly what we tend to get best responses from clients is when we make significant sector hires that improve their own outputs. I think that a journalist once described PRs to me as undertrained and overfamiliar, which always sort of filled me with horror. And so it's always been really important to us to really understand our clients' business as much as understand the business of the media, which is why we represent so many media companies. Also, we make client-side investments, we hire ex-clients. And so I think that's an area that for us is really important, to continue to hire people from our clients' industries, or people, journalists from their clients, or people that are adjacent to it, so actually they can bring as much expertise to really support the client as possible.
Interesting. What would you say is kind of your sort of biggest priority in terms of the services or the sectors that you're looking to invest in over the next year or two?
I think, well, two areas for us: making more acquisitions. Our recent acquisition of Lotus has been really successful, and that follows up with my sort of desire to drive sector expertise. We're on course to have tripled our EBITDA since we acquired them. The other area is pure play creativity. We always won lots of awards for our creativity. I don't know whether you guys are seeing this or not, but there's a lot more desire from clients to buy almost sort of pure creative rather than the levels of thinking that I think a lot of us traditionally do in pitches and with clients. There's just a lot of desire for really, really big ideas. Quite often, I think, seen by a lot more sort of CMOs being involved in pitch processes as well, who actually just want to understand how earned media can really supercharge their own marketing programs above and beyond any media spend they've got. So I think, you know, having hired the first sort of ECD in our category, we're looking to kind of bulk up our creative team as well, because I think there's an insatiable appetite for really, really strong creative ideas across the board.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of creative. That's something that we've been doing as well, investing in our building out our creative team. Healthcare, I think that's I know we're going to come on to talk about talent, but I think that's an area we've seen growth, but also an area that is very much a priority, and it's about getting the right talent into the business and continuing to be able to kind of grow that and kind of meet the opportunities and demand that we've got coming into the business. So I'd say those two areas. I'm not going to talk about data anymore, but that as well.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much a combination of those. So data and analytics, really important. Creative, really important. Healthcare, really important. But I think the other area where we're investing heavily is in strategy, because I think it's where we can really differentiate in the kind of broader marketing mix, is when you come with a stronger point of view that's built from culture. Which I think some of the ad agencies are still really struggling with.
Interesting. Good stuff. Next topic I want to talk about is margins. What we noticed...
You know, Bibi and I can't talk about that.
Well...
Wait, it's my favourite subject. It's going to be fun. You guys go and make a cup of tea.
Maybe you could talk in general terms rather than your own businesses.
Okay, great.
Yeah. What I can talk to you about is the stats we found. I mean, we asked people to give their margin figures in 2017, 2018 anonymously. We noticed there was a slight decline in average margin from 20.2% to 19.7%. Although a majority, 58%, saw margins improve, which suggests the overall figure is distorted by a small number of very big changes. I mean, one of the things that's come out from our analysis is we've seen agencies develop more specialisms that have higher margins, you know, from some of the things we're talking about, video technology, sort of general content creation, data offer, in some cases financial PR services, things like that, and pharma too. And obviously, you know, things like office costs and staff costs play a huge part here too. So margins, what are your thoughts? Is it noticeably tougher? Has it been noticeably tougher in the last few years to sort of maintain margins? I know, obviously, not being able to discuss yours in particular. I mean, what are your sort of thoughts on this topic?
Ours has always been very, very high 20s. I think we're 27 or 28%, which is pretty strong. We've done that through, I think, kind of hustle and agility, and being able to, you know, grow quickly, win lots of pitches, but also retain clients. I think, and we were talking about this earlier, I think the margin has been relatively well protected within the industry, despite the sort of procurement headwinds and the almost crippling cost of pitching now, by the fact that PR people are pretty bloody resourceful. And they're actually all of these diversified services, things that are often sold to existing clients, meaning you have a very limited, if not zero, cost of sale, which is going to be significantly improving your margin. I mean, I think the amount of pitching going on where they take 3, 4, 5 months to go through, and that's expensive if you have 100% win record. If let's say you're doing 1 in 3, which would be, you know, fairly good. You know, it means you have to go through 3 of those just to win one. And the duration of client relationships, I think, is probably lower than it has ever been either. So you've got less amount of time to have to earn more money back just to make the same amount of money. And at some point, that kind of...
But this is a real bugbear for me as an industry, in that we have no basic standards for pitch process. It is literally the Wild West. So there's no basic rules of engagement, things that are expected from the client and or the agency. And I think, you know, recently there was a whole thread on Twitter around pitch kind of horror stories, and they're so frequent now where you can go through. I mean, we've had some pitches that have lasted 9-10 months, and at the end of it you get nothing in response, and then you kind of like talk to your pals and they're like, no we didn't either. And that the amount of money, hard money it costs, but time, resource, emotion that we as agencies put into trying to win a piece of business is, I think, a huge problem for our industry, particularly in terms of margin. And I'd much rather be spending 80% of that money I'm spending on that on talent, because there's a war for talent. So I'd rather be paying people better. I'd rather be bonusing people better. But we're in this constant conundrum. And you know, we were talking earlier, there's always someone who's willing to go with the flow on the process. And so we're, as an industry, we're our own worst nightmare. And I think it should be top of our priority in terms of fixing that.
Mm. Interesting. What are your thoughts, Bevy?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Warren and Joanne. I think the cost of pitching for new business is definitely a challenge. I think that's definitely changed in the last few years. I mean, I think margins are under pressure for big agencies, you know, office costs, talent costs, cost of growing your business. I think it is more challenging. But, I mean, it's good to see the numbers overall that the industry is managing to protect the margin. It doesn't seem like it's shifted much more the average over the past few years. So
yeah, I think that's right. And as I say, I think, you know, this kind of move to the new services, I think, has been a big part of that. I mean, I think one of the general trends I've seen from a number of different parts of the top 150 coverage is that, you know, the industry is working really, really hard to sort of kind of maintain its position, and nothing is coming automatically.
Yeah.
You know, obviously earned media has become an increasingly important thing for lots of clients, but there's no sense that the PR industry is going to necessarily get the advantage of that. It's all about working hard, adding new services where necessary, moving structures, just kind of optimizing what can be optimized, and to tread water and then move ahead and sort of keep things going. So that definitely seems to be
I think we need to be really careful as an industry, though, because I mean, we've seen, you know, the ad creative agencies have their business models really heavily disrupted. We've seen over the last few years the almost kind of collapse in media buying agencies, you know, firepower. At some point, you've got to think that we'll get disrupted in some way, shape, or form too. I think the thing about PR people is I think we're always quite hard on ourselves, probably more than, you know, one of the things I bang on about is we need to have the swagger that the ad land has. But I actually think that probably puts us in quite good stead, because we're always second guessing ourselves and trying to improve. But I think at some point there will be a sort of great disruption. I mean, just looking at your list, there's a hell of a lot of agencies billing quite a lot of money out there. At some point, you know, you question, is that too many? Is it the amount of agencies out there that are driving, you know, allowing this pitch madness to happen? Or actually, it'd be interesting next year to look at average fees. Because we just win more business. The fees aren't going up. The percentage of fees to hard costs is increasing. So hard costs are, you know, when I started it was 50-50. It's now probably 80-20. And at some point, PR budgets have to go up rather than just you doing more for less. So there'll come a point where that becomes untenable.
I mean, is that a real problem, do you think, that this industry that just feels too bashful, too sort of timid to ask for more fees, or is there too much competition?
The problem is we're really good. We're really good as an industry. And when clients say, no, I'm not going to pay for that, you need to find a way to do it. The problem is that we do. And it's great in the short term, but bad in the long term. And so I think we need to slightly push some of those problems back into being costing, and actually bizarrely our own resourcefulness is a problem for us.
Interesting. Okay, going to move on to going to put the subjects of talent and diversity together, because it's hard to shift them, and this was Warren's suggestion early on actually to combine these two, because I think it's a very sound point. I mean, on the sort of specifically the talent front, what we saw, we were asking people what the biggest challenges for the year ahead, and talent was perhaps unsurprisingly chosen as the top one. And the staff churn figures increased slightly, again, not by much, but 2017, 17.2%, 2018, 18.6%. This is across the top 150 as an average. So, you know, you might expect it will be much higher at certain agencies and certain sectors. But what's clear is that the battle to attract and retain top talent is as fierce as ever. And in terms of diversity, I mean, there was the recent CIPR survey that put the industry is 92% white. I mean, we found that 72% of people on boards were white, I believe. I might have to double check that. But certainly in terms of gender as well, and I know it's a bit crude to sort of lump all of these things together, but nevertheless, just to give a kind of an overview, 65% of staff across the top 150 agencies were female, and 50% of the people on boards were female. So there's clearly a underrepresentation there. There's a lot to get through. It's a big, very big question. But what do you think the sort of the key problems are here when it comes to attracting and retaining talent and having a diverse workforce?
That's a huge question.
There it is.
Can I start on the gender one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just
put my women in PR hat on.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think we're right to discuss this as a combined topic, because I think that the key, and Warren and we were all talking about this earlier, I think the key to unlocking this challenge we all have around talent and retaining talent and kind of all fighting after the best people is to look in different places. And that means being open to more diverse talent. And that also means looking for talent in different places and then building a more inclusive culture. But just on the gender point, I think that being brutally honest, I just think it's really disappointing that number, about 50% leadership teams being female in an industry that's 2/3 female. I think that it just shows that we are not changing quickly enough, because there really is no reason on earth that the leadership teams of the top 150 agencies shouldn't reflect the gender dynamics of our industry. And I think what that says to me is that we're not doing enough as a collective to make changes to address that, because I think we can be sure the reasons behind that are that curve where you're seeing, you know, it is a kind of very old kind of classic example, but you're just seeing women falling out of our industry or not reaching their potential, not reaching leadership because of working in agencies that aren't able to support them having through a family. And I'm pretty sure how you're going to see that curve. And I think as you're now seeing more and more men wanting to take time out to be fathers, that you're going to have the same challenges. And I think we need to be doing more to champion flexible working, to be able to support women when they're going on maternity leave and returning, to creating workplaces that are, you know, that you're able to manage the demands of family life. And I think that goes for men and women. And I think that is the key to addressing that. And I would really like to see that balance shifting.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts on, well, I guess gender, first of all, and the sort of diversity point, gender and ethnicity, the particular problems this industry has as opposed to other
industries?
Yeah,
I think so. I mean, for me, we've looked at it and our numbers are in line with the industry, and, you know, which is obviously not strong. I think that we need a really different way of looking at it. And I think it's rather than attracting talent, I think it's about creating talent. I think our problem is we keep looking at the same pool of university educated people doing degrees in PR in Bournemouth, and they're like us. They're all, you know, so we're hiring like for like. And I think that our job as an industry is to go and talk to people at school that are 14, 16 that perhaps weren't going to university, certainly don't even know what PR is. It's our job to inspire them into thinking that PR could be an option for them, and stop demanding university degrees, stop demanding... I think you guys did something about... So that, I thought, was fantastic. And I think they're the types of things, rather than kind of, you know, going around, you know, doing kind of ethnicity quotas, I think it's less about skin colour or ethnicity. It's more about social mobility. And actually, I think you can attract much more diverse talent by concentrating on younger people and inspiring them as part of this really bloody exciting industry that we've all had a great time in. And I think that for me is the biggest thing that as an industry we need to tackle.
But for me, it's, you know, I remember this being talked about when I first came into PR 17 years ago, and we've made very little progress across the diversity spectrum, which is huge. And so there's an element of, we have to be much more intentional. Rather than just saying we need to be more diverse, we actually have to do kind of concrete things about it. And so at Ketchum, like on the female stuff at Ketchum, 75% of my exec team's female, 68% of my board is female. I've got up to 65% of my creative team is female. So, you know, we're being very intentional about reflecting. 75% of my agency is female, right? So I'm trying to reflect what my agency is. And now I'm kind of moving on to social, I'm moving on to ethnicity. And it's really, really hard. And I think we think it's easy. It's kind of, well, we just need to change, you know, our recruitment process, or we just need to change our job descriptions. And it's not a silver bullet. There are like a million arrows that you need to fire in order to start to change that dynamic. And I think as an industry as a whole, we talk about it every year, but we make no progress. And it's kind of like, when are we going to say enough is enough and demand certain things from our agencies? And I think clients are starting to demand it. Now, more and more often we're being asked, in the last three pitches we've done in the first quarter, we've been asked for our diversity statistics.
Really?
And I love that. I mean, I love it in part because we're very strong in this area. But at the same time, I'm like, good, it's going to force some agencies to actually walk the talk rather than just say it.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree. I think... I'm pleased to say our leadership team also reflects the industry, 60% female as well. But it's, I think we're all really good at talking about these issues, but I think that we have to take some real action. And I agree with Warren that it is about looking at that kind of junior entry level and where we're all looking for talent. I think the programme you're referring to is that we pay for living costs for our interns. We've always paid our interns, but the last couple of years we now pay for accommodation, because we worked out that if you, I don't know, say live in the north of England, you want to move to London to start your career, you don't have financial family support, you need something like £5,000 in your back pocket to move to London, to pay a month's rent up front, etc. And so that was a real barrier for us being able to unlock talent. But I think that with all of these different types of diversity, I think that as well as looking at a junior level, we've also got to make the change at mid and senior levels. And to your point, Joanne, that's what makes it really difficult, I think, as agency leaders, is that we've got to affect all of this change at the same time, because the risk is otherwise you recruit brilliant diverse candidates at a junior level. They come in, they settle, and then they look up and go, nobody at the top that looks like me, is from the same background as me. And then,
but if those people aren't in industry, how do you?
But they are.
They are in the industry, and I think that. But they might be in, not necessarily in a classic agency where you always fish, or they might be people who are on a family career break that we could get back, or they might be have set up their own one person agency and would like to actually return to big agency. And so I think that it's about, and that's actually really good for us when we're all fighting in battles using recruiters over the same talent and paying, you know, 20% for the privilege. I think that finding talent from maybe more unusual sources, being more creative about it, is good for diversity, and it's also really good for us as a business. And I think that if we don't start addressing some of these, none of us will have a business in 5 to 10 years, because we won't be being, to your point, being invited to pitch.
It is interesting, isn't it, about the increasing number of clients asking for these things. Mm. I mean, do you think that relates directly, I mean, to some, you know, some campaigns that I sort of think off the top of my head that I won't mention here, the last couple of years that have really been kind of clangers? And part of the reason is a complete lack of sensitivity and understanding about people who don't come from the same background.
Yeah.
So it's not just a case of clients are doing this because it looks like a nice thing to do. They're doing it because they've had enough of people who can't think outside the bubble they live in.
Definitely. I definitely think that I think I probably know one of the campaigns that you're thinking about. No, I definitely hear that from clients. I think it's probably also one of the positive things that procurement is doing for the whole Marcoms industry, because they are also sort of tasked with, that's another element of what they're being tasked with, because at the, you know, the top level of all these big blue chip companies, they're also having to change. They've got activist investors. They have to now provide this data to their own shareholders. So therefore, they're telling procurement, well, any supplier and partner we work with has got to adhere to the same changes. Because if, you know, on their own boards, they're having to affect that kind of diversity, there's no point going to work with a partner who's going to field, you know, a team of 5 white men to work on their business. So I think that pressure is just going to continue.
I've never heard anyone in PR say a positive thing about procurement. I don't think so. This is probably a first. You heard it here first. But interesting.
One positive thing about procurement.
One positive thing about procurement. maybe sort of, you know, broadening this issue out a bit more, we talk about kind of retaining talent, and a lot of this comes down into the sort of workplace practices. And someone mentioned earlier on a little bit about flexible working. I mean, where do you think this sort of industry can do better when it comes to a kind of more general being a positive workplace environment and having positive practices?
Well, I think what's interesting that I've seen over the last couple of years is when we are losing people, it's very rarely now to another agency. So it's very rarely like for like, or even to in-house. It's often because they're choosing to do something completely different. Like one person went and set up a yoga retreat in the south of France.
It's always a yoga retreat.
It's amazing, right? One person decided to go travel the world and then trained as a teacher. So like real fundamental changes. And I think... because we'd started to see that, that's why we've worked really hard at changing some of the ways in which we work. So we no longer have core hours as an agency. We have what we call smart working, which is just 100% flexibility. So you can choose where and when you work, week in, week out, as long as you're putting your client and your team at the heart of that and you're all communicating and coordinating and making sure that's right. But there are some unintended consequences of that, because then there are no hard boundaries, right? So if you work in a job that is very much, you know, 9 to 5:30 and you come in at 9, you leave at 5:30 and you kind of, you've got your life either side of it. If you're given permission to work 100% flexibly, some people find that really hard to then draw the boundaries. So then you get into long hours. So you're constantly having to help and support people make the choices that are right for them. And so I always say flexibility isn't right for some people. Some people like a very structured kind of, I come in at this time, I leave at this time, that's how I manage my life. Other people, like me, I mean, I kind of, sometimes people say to me, you work 24/7, and I'm like, I don't, I just work very flexibly. And so I'll work at odd times sometimes because it fits around my family life and my interests and whatever it might be. So I don't think it's as simple as just saying you can work flexibly. You have to help individuals make the right choices for them that allows them to balance, you know, their life in its entirety.
I also think there's we get a lot of this from much younger people entering the industry, and it's, you know, I'm slightly sceptical. I think you've got to learn the craft and the trade first before you can start working off-site. You know, you can only, as a junior entering the industry, you have to learn from senior people around you. There's no one that's so brilliant that they can go and work, you know, for 3 hours at home every day and develop their skills as much as they need to. So I completely agree, at a certain level, it works perfectly. And I run a similar day to what you've done. But I think if you're trying to create a culture of best-in-class work and camaraderie and all of those types of things that you need to create in an office environment, I think too much flexibility, certainly amongst juniors, can be really counterproductive.
I don't know that I agree with that, because I think, well, certainly in our business, so many of our teams are global. We're a globally driven business, so a lot of teams are virtual anyway. So people are using technology and different ways in which to be in their team without kind of sitting in the same physical location. So I think you can still learn and develop. I mean, I encourage, as part of smart working, it's not just about working from home. I mean, it's work from anywhere that makes you more productive, more creative, whatever it might be. So I encourage loads of our people, go and work in the client's offices. Spend a day, 2 days a week integrated with them, hearing and listening to them. So it's kind of about work where it makes most sense at the time that it makes most sense to get the best possible work. And I think that relates whether you're an intern or whether you're the CEO.
Maybe a global level, certainly not from a UK perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I do agree with you, Warren, that I think that in our business, it's a creative business and people need to come together in some kind of space at some point. I do agree with that. And I think, you know, there's a lot of chat about virtual agencies, etc. And I certainly don't think that's the way our business is going to go personally. However, saying that, I'm a huge champion for flexible working. And I think in our business, we have a difference between people who have what I would call formal flexible terms. So they do all different things. They might do a 3-day week or a 4-day week or compressed hours so they can do pick up, or because there are other things that they do outside of work. And then just general flexibility. So, you know, we have unlimited holiday and people can work from home, and that's kind of goes for all of our team. I think that the the flexible working point is really important, linking back to particularly what we're saying about retaining parents and particularly retaining women to leadership, because I think that there is absolutely no reason why you could not work a 4-day week. So it means that you have one day that you either spend with your family or means you can do school drop off and pick up and still have a very senior leadership role. Maybe I'm biased because that's what I do, but I think that that is really important. And, you know, particularly now, the role that I'm doing, Women in PR, and we talk about this a lot, Joanne and I on the committee, there are a lot of senior women in our industry who come to us and tell their stories and talk about, you know, I've been with Blar Agency for decades and, you know, I just want to work a 4-day week so I can do pick up at least one day a week and they won't let me. And that to me just seems really short-sighted. It's a small change and that person is probably delivering a huge amount for the business. And I think that you're then at risk of losing some of that talent. And I think that's probably why we aren't seeing those numbers, why the leadership, women on the leadership team is not reflecting the overall demographic of the industry.
I'm surprised you're saying people aren't allowed to work a 4-day week. Yeah. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, we get quite a lot.
Really?
Had one today. Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's a small change, but I think
it's hard for women though. My wife's done it. Sophie Rain, my deputy MD, does it now. It's really hard to work because it's a full-time job. And it's really, and I've seen Sophie and Clem wrestle with how you sort of switch off for that final day. It's really tough.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think you, as a senior leader, if you're going to work flexibly, I think then you have a responsibility to be a good role model to more junior people in the agency, in terms of saying, okay, you know, on a Friday I'm with my kids and I'm not going to answer emails. Yeah. I mean, there's always exceptions. In the same way, I think in our business, you know, you get the call at 2 a.m. because the client's having a crisis. I mean, we all know that our business really is 7-day a week responsibility. So I don't think that's any different. But I think the benefit that you can have as a business by enabling people to work a bit more flexibly and spend time with their families or do other things, I think I would like to stress that it's not just about mums or parents. I think that we're definitely seeing people wanting to work more flexibly because, you know, they might do yoga. Or...
Yeah, exactly. We've got some people who work contractual, like 4 days a week because they spend one day doing an outside interest.
Yeah.
Side hustle,
I think that can actually be good for your business. Totally. That they're getting inspiration from elsewhere. So, yeah.
But I think we're really fortunate because we're an industry that is essentially 24/7, being able to offer people, empower people and trust people to manage their time in the most effective way. And I think what's interesting is we've moved to smart working, which is 100% flexibility. Our office is full almost every day because we've got a great culture. So people want to come and spend time together. But when they want to use flexibility for whatever reason, they don't have to go through a process to ask. And we get very few now contractual requests to work a 4-day week or whatever it might be, because people can just build that into that point about knowing I'm not here every Monday is very stressful, whereas knowing that I can kind of leave at 4 3 days a week to do pickup and then work later that night to make sure I'm delivering what needs to be delivered is actually quite empowering. So people can make the right choice for whatever their lifestyle is.
Interesting. Well, fascinating stuff there. I want to move on to a completely different... Well, not completely, because everything's linked, isn't it? But it does seem like a bit of a switch, but mergers and acquisitions. There you go.
Whoa! Yeah.
Nice segue there, John.
There it is. Thanks. Yeah. We're going to stop talking about that, and now we're going to talk about this. Yeah. But I would argue that there is a link, because in a sense, when you're... about buying people,
go on,
isn't
then.
It? I mean, you know, you can either... If you want to employ loads of... you know, you want to add a tech team, say, it's probably easier to buy a small tech agency than to hire 15 people in one go who are tech experts. So there you go. There's my link.
There you go. Well done.
Seamless. There's no way this is going to be cut out. This is this bit's gold dust. M&A. We looked at data for the top 150 from Results International that shows M&A in UK PR, i.e. number of PR agencies bought, sold, accelerated a bit in 2018, despite... Brexit and other challenges. Consensus seems to be that UK remains a preeminent PR market with skills and experience that won't simply disappear when we leave the EU, making it attractive to buyers, plus the relative weakness of the pound has helped. Not that there aren't plenty of challenges. While global listed Marcoms groups have generally steered clear of acquisitions of traditional PR, at least recently, private equity and non-listed trade buyers have stepped in, particularly US firms or North American firms, I should probably say, that want a presence over here. Warren, you've obviously been involved in M&A recently. What are your thoughts on the opportunities for buying?
Well, you've identified the main one, which is obviously the pound is super weak. So certainly if you're coming in from Asia or North America, there's great buying opportunities. What I've observed, which is quite interesting, which I'd love to say I foresaw, but I just happened to be as part of it. But there seemed to be a huge amount of acquisitions for UK-based travel expert agencies. I think there were three, one of which was ours, three deals done in about 3 months. So I think there's maybe pockets of particular expertise that's being sort of gobbled up quite quickly. But I think you're right. There seems to be lots of buyers coming from quite bizarre areas as well. There's things like, I don't know whether you guys saw the deal with the Troika that bought Mission, which kind of collapsed in quite aggressive lawsuits in either way, which doesn't seem like a natural, no one had heard of them beforehand. So yes, the kind of classic, IPG or any of those types of deals don't seem to be going through, because I guess on certain aspects, when you're acquiring as a PLC, the valuations probably don't stack up enough for the market. So I think you are seeing a lot of other, but having said that, PR agencies are very cash generative. So people in business like to buy them because they can usually pay for themselves relatively quickly. So I think there will be, there's quite a lot of A's. There's not as many M's in the M&A place. And I think that obviously there's some internal group mergers, but it'll be interesting to see whether there's over time they'll start to be some other actual proper mergers. I'd certainly predict anything, something significant in the next year or so, because I think that as costs look to increase, certainly in terms of the cost of pitching, the cost of acquiring talent, at some point people are going to look to kind of move together to start to pull back office costs and start to look to, because I think we're close to breaking point of if people need to sustain margin any further, they're going to have to start finding other ways of cutting costs, and headcount isn't one, but back office costs might be. So I think we might see some more M's as part of M&A.
Interesting. Yeah, well, there's certainly been quite a few M's recently, and there's going to be some more coming up, perhaps with SEC and Porter recently talking about plans to merge. And obviously we know the big ones, Burson Cohen & Wolf, and a few smaller ones as well, like BECG and a few others. I know you two are obviously in a slightly different position, since you can't go out and just buy an agency yourself. Oh. Maybe you can, I don't know.
Never say
maybe
nothing.
Personally. What do you got any sort of particular reflections on M&A? Do you wish you had company would just buy some agencies? And obviously, I guess you had Brooklyn, wasn't too long
shopping.
Ago.
Yeah. I'm not going to deny that. I know Joanne does as well. I think over the last few years, we've made quite a few acquisitions. So the last one being Brooklyn Brothers in 2016. So we went through a phase of making quite a few. I mean, I think that we're always, open. Obviously, you get opportunities all the time. But I think that period that we went through was very strategic in adding certain disciplines or areas of expertise to our portfolio. And I think at the moment, we launched a new positioning about 6 months or so ago, and it's about that very much is about bringing all of those together. And I think with things like data and analytics, we've made the decision that we want to build that from the ground up, because we want to put it at the heart of our existing business rather than buying, say, a bolt-on business. So yeah, never say never.
Interesting. Joanne?
Yeah, I mean, the Omnicom standards for merger and acquisition are extremely high. So being able to find something that meets their thresholds is difficult. But like BB, we're constantly we've got our eye on the market. We're looking for something that strategically would add to the agency. But it's not something that Omnicom doesn't acquire frequently. And so if you do make a pitch for it, it has to be an absolutely solid case. And I think one of the interesting things looking at the top 150 from a financial point of view is you just see massive leaps at different parts of the list and size of agencies. Size of agency is very important to Omnicom. So whilst we keep our eye on it, I think we do a lot of building from the inside in terms of our strengths and where we need to develop. And actually, I think we've never been more integrated within Omnicom Public Relations Group. So we work way more frequently than we ever have with Fleischmann, with Porter, with Portland, to maximise the strengths across those four agencies as well, which is helping us to win a lot more business.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And sort of going on to Warren's point about the M rather than the A, I mean, do you sort of think generally we'll see more mergers of of sister agencies coming up, or indeed.
It would make sense, wouldn't it? I mean, the kind of Sorrel strategy of making sure that you've got a separate brand on the entire pitch list, so at least one of them wins, I think is, you know, a bit old hat now. So I would, if I was a betting man, I would certainly put some more money on some big mega mergers like that for sure. You two have been quite tight-lipped.
No idea.
Fair enough.
No plan.
Leading to that,
no plans
what you will.
Made aware of.
Good. Okay, well, I'm going to move along from M&A. I know you're all really excited to talk about retainer versus project. You've all, listeners, heard that reaction. So maybe we keep this really, really brief. I'm going to tell you what we found. So while many agency chiefs say the direction of traffic is moving away from retainers and towards project work, as it has been for some time, our data suggests it's the proportion of retained work remained broadly unchanged from 2017 to 2018. Some agencies say they're purposely avoiding project briefs where they can, or diversifying their offer again to encourage a greater number of retained relationships. Would anyone like to say anything on project versus retainer, or do you rather not?
I can. I think we're seeing more of a kind of hybrid. I don't think it's as binary as project or retainer. I think there's a protainer, which is we're seeing a lot of lower baseline, the annual fees with almost sort of guaranteed top ups, which, if I'm honest, is providing us a certain level of commitment there. It's a kind of a more acceptable version of zero budgeting. And it means that, you know, increasingly those big PR fees are relentlessly scrutinised. And actually, if you can attribute top-ups to smaller specific projects, we found that clients find that more sympathetic to their own internal budgeting. So net-net, you end up with the same amount of money, but there's not just that big, great big, you know, sort of huge fee on a monthly basis, which I think puts a lot of pressure on the agency to kind of, you know, demonstrate value. Mm. Whereas if each time there's a specific client-originated mini brief or mini project that comes up, they've briefed that in. So I think it works well for both parties. What we're beginning to see a bit more of is actually that version, but with zero retainer. And that actually becomes really costly because you're actually then doing a mini pitch each time. And that's, for us, a kind of line that we can't go beyond because it is really unprofitable. But I think the kind of the hybrid version, I think, given the current new climates we're in, I think works well for client and agency.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think the reason I slightly groan at this question is I guess it's been a debate that's been going on for a long time. And I think that in our business, we work on a lot of big blue chip clients and we sit on big rosters. And the work there has often historically been project-based work, but in many cases is annualised project work.
Exactly.
Which obviously has, you know, great value to us as a business. And I think that there's always been this perception that somehow retained work is more valuable and more secure than necessarily project work. And project work is kind of seen as more fly by night and unreliable. And I think that we see that differently because a lot of our project work is for some of our kind of largest, you know, most famous brands that we work for. And, you know, in many cases, they're projects that we've been doing every year for the past 10 years or more. So I think it's that sort of definition between one of the retainer being more valuable than project, which is where I kind of disagree. I think that, as with everything, is you need a balance between all of those different types of ways of working with clients, because it's the forecasting that's the real challenge. And whether it's a project or whether it's retained work, what we're all striving for, I think, is more predictable revenue income. Because that's how we're able to map talent, and that goes back to the big challenge around talent. So that's how I would see it.
It's exactly the same as BB, but I think the other thing I would say is I think there's more opportunity than ever for unsolicited ideation with clients, because their businesses are changing as rapidly as we are, and so they're looking for consultants who are thinking about that and are ahead of the curve. And so you can go and pitch to them a big idea that becomes a project, which is real work that matters and that makes an impact and that's award winning, rather than kind of the constraints of a retainer, which is essentially this is what we need to deliver month in, month out, which is incredibly valuable and important work. But often it's those projects that allow you to really make the leap. So I totally agree with you. The balance is what's important.
Good stuff. Well, I think we're almost done. But I did want to end with just asking a question. If we were going to be sat here a year from now and looking back on how the past year had been, what do you think will be the biggest changes from what we were discussing now? What would have been the big differences?
Personally or in the industry?
In the industry.
I mean, my dream is that we make a significant practical leap forward on diversity, that we actually see some fundamental positive changes in that area and that we're not just having the same conversation again.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think those statistics, you're not going to make a significant impact on those in a year, but it would be good to see some new industry standards. And I think we should say it's good that PR Week are asking for that data on diversity this year. Who knows? Will we no longer be European? Don't know. Hopefully we're not still having that debate in a year.
Yeah,
gosh. We probably will.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a couple of big deals to go through. I think there'll be a couple of businesses that will quietly go under. So I think there'll be quite a lot of churn in the agency landscape over the next 12 months.
Interesting. Good stuff. Well, can't wait to see if that all comes to fruition. But that's it. Thank you all so much for being involved, and thanks to Marketeers for hosting the podcast. And thanks to the listeners for listening, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the PR Show podcast with John Harrington. Brought to you by PR Week. If you've liked what you've heard, please leave us a nice review.